That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Hey, and welcome to the latest That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. If you listened to last week's episode, then you would know that today is the big launch day for College Football Bachelorette, which is the new conceit that I'm introducing that's going to help me find my college football team. I've gone 30 plus years without having a rooting interest in any team other than my Cornell Big Red, which unfortunately is not a big-time college football program. So this year, I am using this season to whittle down 24 attractive football teams into one football suitor that I will choose bachelorette style on college game day in November, and that will be the team that I root for. That will be the bandwagon I jump on. And so if you go to ESPNW, College Football Bachelorette, where I'll post the links on Twitter and social media, you can find out what the 24 teams I'm starting with are and how I'm going to whittle down each week. And I'm going to use your suggestions and tips and information to help make my decisions. So make sure you check that out. Again, I'll be posting a bunch of links on social media, so you'll be able to find it. And every once in a while on the podcast, I'll have different guests that pop on to talk about it, or maybe just give you guys updates on some of the teams that seem to be faring well or teams that have gotten cut. Today, my guest is someone who is a big fan of The Bachelor and Bachelorette. We didn't get into it, but I'm going to have him back on later in the season to help me out with this because he is a big-time college football player and a big-time Bachelor watcher. It's Mike Golic Jr., and we're going to get into sort of his career path, working in the shadow of a famous father, playing football in the shadow of a famous father and uncle, and how he's kind of found his own way as a late-20s person, really getting started in this industry, but taking over in a lot of really cool ways and making his mark at a pretty young age, considering how long it usually takes to get things going in the sports industry and the entertainment industry in general. So it's a good convo. Gojo, as he is called, is a great guy. So take a listen. Here it is.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Happy now to welcome in Mike Golic Jr. You can hear him on First and Last if you're up very early. Not quite as early, Weekend Observations with co-host Stu Gatz. That's on Sunday mornings early. You can also hear him often on Mike and Mike, even calling some high school football games lately. So, jack of all trades, thanks for making some time for me. It is middle of the afternoon, so I guess that's why you're available. Otherwise, you'd be sleeping, right?
Yeah, exactly. I come out of my morning slumber. So this is actually, if you're going to rework the clock for my weird sleep schedule, this is like my morning right now.
Nice. Yeah, what is your vampiric schedule like? What is your average day in terms of sleep?
Generally, because I want to stay up, and you know, we're an early show, so we're getting a lot of the first reaction to whatever happened the night before, and whether it's NFL games now on, you know, Monday and Thursday, or during NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs, I want to stay up and watch the game. So I go to bed at like 11:30, midnight, sleep till 2:30, 2:40, and then go into work from there. And then once I'm done, unless I'm sticking around for, you know, SportsCenter, Mike and Mike, or one of those other things, I can go home right after and try and knock out for as long as I can before I got to kind of get up and start the whole process over again.
This is a young man's game, to be sure. Just the fact that you plan and schedule a couple hours before you work is that'll throw you off. And what happens when you – I mean, I know what happens when you try to be a part of a normal everyday life, because we were at Prim Sripa Pat's wedding together and you missed your show because you were just acting like a normal 27-year-old at a wedding.
Yeah, that tends to happen. That one, you know what, I obviously, you know, took responsibility at the time, said all the right things, but I'm formally going to put myself in the camp. I think daylight savings time is a travesty, and it really cost me dearly in that one. So instead of missing 15 minutes of a show, I missed an hour and 15 minutes of a show, and all hope was lost, and I broke a hotel remote control. It was a whole ordeal.
Now, were you depending on the alarm of the hotel room?
No, see, that was my mistake, as I was depending on the alarm of my phone, and I didn't go down and have them call me from the front desk. I didn't schedule a wake-up call.
So your phone didn't automatically update itself?
No, I don't know what it did. I don't know if I was just – I mean, listen, we we certainly were out carrying on for a while at that yes. wedding. So there's a very real chance I just slept through the alarm. But waking right. up and looking over at my phone and seeing the first text I saw, because I saw a bunch of voicemails, because, you know, Stu Gotz, he's going to make it into a production. And
of course.
They just spent the whole show. Any guest they had on called me and left me a voicemail. They spent the whole time putting out the search signal. And the only text I saw when I woke up was from my mom. It was from 20 minutes after the show started. And it just said, "Oh, no, Mike."
Well, that's funny, because I did not have a show that morning, but I woke up to a text from your dad that said, "Do you know where my son is?"
Well, you were connected. You were the last bit of
communication. I was the last tweet.
The last tweet was a response to a picture that you had put up of me and the bride, Prim Saripapat, and then followed by my whoop, 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 whoop tweet that ended up being the tweet heard around the world that morning.
Yes, I actually found it. "Hey, Sarah, Mike Golick here, the dad. The son, Junior, is MIA in his show this morning. Any clue as to maybe when he left the wedding or what hotel he was staying at? We never got that info. Ha ha. Thanks. Never mind. We got him."
I like how they were so calm about it. Like, I could have been anywhere. There could have been something actually wrong. And
no,
I looked on Twitter,
not, yeah.
and my mom is just publicly flaming me on Twitter. She's throwing memes up, making fun of me.
I mean, I'm pretty certain that first of all, it would have been terrible had you come up, you know, dead in an alley. And you know, the last comments from your family were flaming you for missing your show and being a deadbeat. That would have been unfortunate. But
you know,
I think
what?
It was pretty clear to all involved that you got lit at a wedding and you didn't quite wake up in time.
We've all been there, am I right?
Right. Not, maybe not for a show.
Maybe not.
Maybe not for a live radio show. But we've all been late to work, that's for sure. All right, let's rewind way, way back. I want to hear about – so you were born in Jersey, but you spent most of your – young years in West Hartford, which is near Bristol, obviously, because your dad, Mike Golick, has been working for ESPN forever. So tell me about life outside of ESPN, being the son of one of ESPN's biggest names. How did that affect who you kind of were as you grew up?
I think it was one of those things. I was fortunate that the situation was pretty constant from the time I was young. So it wasn't like, you know, I got to the point where I was 14 or 15 in high school, and all of a sudden my dad was on TV and he started to get known a little differently, and you started to deal with more of the things that come with, you know, their show being a family show and a lot of our happenings in the family becoming fodder for air. Like, that was the one thing that always got made very clear to us, was if you do something funny or worthy of getting told on the show, it's getting put out there. So you meet a lot of people that end up knowing weird details about your family
right.
life, because it's all put out there on Front Street. But it was like that from the time that I was so young that it was always normal. Like, the number one question I always got was, is it weird seeing your dad on TV? And I always tell people, I've been watching my dad on TV since I was 9 years old, so it would be weird for me to not see him on TV. Like,
right,
that would be a
absolutely.
Strange thing for it to be the other way for me. And so you kind of just always understand, like, kind of the thing we lob at college and pro athletes is you understand that you've got more eyes on you because of the position that you're in, and then there's a lot mm-hmm. of goods that come with it, but you still have to be a little bit guarded in the way things go down. And that was just kind of how I grew up. I understood that if I got in trouble or if anything happened, there was going to be extra heat on me because he was a public figure, because he was someone that worked in the media. And you just sort of understood that, accepted it, and operated as such.
Yeah, that happens a lot with writers as well. The families or the loved ones of writers know that they're going to end up in the stories, in you know, the coverage. So that can either go one of two ways. Either you become very aware early on and you're smart, or you sort of lash out because there's this unnecessary and early pressure to be constantly aware of everything. Were there moments ever where you kind of pushed back against needing to be known, especially since you have the exact same name as him?
No, I don't think so. It's one of those things that never really manifested itself in a negative way. Obviously, the more I grew up, and like everyone else, like a lot of people, they emulate their parents and they try, you know, they want to do some of the things that their parents did. And mine just happened to be both very public spaces. Like, I wanted to play football like my dad did. And eventually I always kind of knew I was interested in doing something in the media the way that my dad did. We're similar personalities. It's what I grew up around. And so in that space, it, you know, it got trying at times, constantly having that pressure of knowing, you know, your dad played 9 years in the NFL and your dad's been part of one of the most successful morning shows. And so you have that constant comparison. But the way I always looked at it was, in all of those realms, the good so far outweighed any sort of the minor negatives, because I had someone that had been through those places. I had someone that helped put me at ease in a lot of situations that other people in the same situation may not have a guide or a mentor who's as direct. And so there's no one. I mean, the first time I filled in on Mike and Mike, I was a nervous wreck. I was terrified. I got maybe an hour of sleep that night before. And then you get on set and something just as simple as it being your dad and him kind of knowing the things in general that make you tick. And so he's able to tee you up on them. It becomes, you know, we want things to be conversational in general in radio and in the media, but to have that conversation with your dad immediately just put me in a place where it was a lot easier to assimilate. And you could say that, you know, find examples of that when I was playing football and how he made life easier on me like that. So the good always so outweighed the bad that there was never really any reason to lash out.
Yeah, I want to get to the potential for bad later, but let's go back to you as a kid. What did you want to be? Did you always want to be an NFL player because of your dad and your uncle?
You know, originally I wanted to be a hockey player. I grew up, ironically enough, we lived in Scottsdale for a little bit. My dad was working at ESPN's affiliate KGME out there, a local sports radio station. And I grew up and I was playing hockey out there in the middle of the desert where you had to drive for a while to find a rink and ice time and all that. And then I moved to Connecticut where it's actually cold and decided at that point that hockey wasn't for me and I wanted to play football. Mostly because when I was a little kid, you couldn't actually hit anyone. So I just spent 90% of the game in the penalty box because I wasn't exactly, you know, fleet of skate. So I was just out there trying to dummy kids. And so it ended
up. I would have
like
been a lot better at field hockey if we could take people out too. I mean, I was very successful by just running people over, but if there were full on checks in field hockey, I really could have had a future.
Exactly. We could play to our strengths a little bit more.
Exactly.
I mean, that's all any of us can really do. And so once that ship kind of sailed early on, it was one of those things very early. I wanted to play football. More than anything, the more I look back on it now, is I wanted to play at Notre Dame. Like, that was always really my goal. Was I grew up around that place and so, you know, revering that place, that was really the most immediate goal. Once I got there, then it's like, all right, you want to try and play in the NFL too. You understand that that's an avenue and all of this, but Notre Dame was really always the end-all be-all for me.
Yeah. And then was there ever a thought of the broadcast side of things? Is that something that always seemed like what would come after that just because of your dad?
Yeah, again, you know, it's like we always talk about in a lot of different avenues, and whether it's, you know, for minority groups, whether it's seeing women in positions of power or, you know, young black boys and girls being able to see young, you know, black men and women in positions where they one day want to be, having someone that so immediately looks like you and is of you in that position makes it seem very readily attainable and makes it seem like something that, all right, if I go about this the right way, I've seen it's very much possible for me to do. And I think just, you know, always being a similar personality type, most people around me would tell you I'm not really one that ever shuts up, which can be, you know, good and bad for a lot of the people close to me. But, yeah, you know, I got to Notre Dame and was a film and television major. We didn't have communications or anything like that there. I always did behind-the-scenes stuff with our football team. And it just – one of those things that came naturally and seemed fun to me and that I kept exploring and kept liking what I found.
Yeah, so you're studying television and film at Notre Dame. You're an offensive guard. Your teammates with Manti Te'o. Tell me what that was like when he went through the crazy stuff that happened later in his career. Were you close with him?
I wasn't. No, it's just one of those things in a college locker room, especially that's, you know, double the size of its pro counterpart in most instances.
Right.
You're not around everyone, and he was, you know, forget being on defense. He was a year younger than me. All these different reasons why it wasn't the case, but you're still cognizant of the situation because when, you know, she quote unquote died. We forget that also his grandmother died that same weekend, so the rest of us are looking at this like, man, that's a tough spot for a teammate. You certainly want to be there for a guy. We're getting ready in the middle of a game week, but we also knew that it was sort of a long-distance girlfriend. It was new. It was kind of this weird situation, and so you kind of looked at it and moved on, but to see the way that that story gained traction, and then it was after the season when it finally broke. We had already lost the title game. I was down in Montgomery, Alabama, playing at what used to be the old blue-gray postseason all-star game, kind of like the C-list Senior Bowl of sorts. And I'm down there, and Manti's teammate from high school, Robbie Toma, was a wideout for us at Notre Dame and was playing in that game with me. And we were there. He was really close with Manti. He grew up, was one of his best friends. and it broke in the middle of that week. So you've got the two of us surrounded by all of these kids from other schools who are now just open season on Notre Dame. Like, oh, you guys don't have real girls on campus. All every joke you can imagine started getting lobbed at us. And I'm just sitting there like, all right, whatever. But like Robbie, that was his boy. That was his friend that all of a sudden's going through this. So he shut up in his room and I'm just kind of checking on him every once in a while. It was one of those things where everyone just started linking up and trying to figure out, like, all right, we knew it was sort of a strange situation with the girlfriend, but man, none of us expected this.
Yeah, that's still one of the weirdest sports stories ever. I still feel confused when I look back and try to put it all together.
It's one of the crazy things, too, because I really thought about this for Manti, because it was something that people tried to make it out towards the end, like maybe he was complicit in it, maybe he was in on it and trying to use it as a marketing ploy. And I always rebuke that. Like, Manti was a lot of things. He wasn't nefarious in that way.
Right.
I think this is just a kid that, you know, grew up on an island where, from what I understand, in his family situation, he was a little sheltered as far as it came to girls. And so may have been willing to believe a few more things and got going in a story that he couldn't control. But looking forward to it now, I always said it's the shame for him is he could have gone forward and his NFL career has been hot and cold because of injury. He could have gone forward and been the best linebacker in the league and been an all-pro, and his life story still would have been defined by that one moment.
The Catfish, although anyone who's seen the show Catfish knows, I guess it's not as easy as many think to to avoid situations like that. Some people are just built to be more likely to fall for that stuff. All right, so you graduate from Notre Dame, and you end up spending time with the Steelers, Saints, Montreal Alouettes, Arizona Rattlers. Did you play at any of those places, or was it always a matter of you get in there, you're in camp for a couple months, and then you get cut before you get to see the action?
Yeah, so there were all kind of different weird situations. Like, for the Steelers, that was the first one out. I got cut at the end of training camp there. You know, kept working out, did a couple of workouts with different teams throughout the year, never ended up signing, so you work out the rest of the offseason. I always kind of went into it basically saying, I got like a 2 or 3 year buffer here where if I can stick around and be tangent to this whole process enough, I've got a shot, and I'll work through it through there. So I do that. I go to the Saints next offseason, and I get cut this time. Instead of making it to training camp, I get cut in the middle of June because they signed a vet after the cap date. And that was when you go up to Canada and you're thinking, all right, I'll go to training camp there. I'll try and, you know, get on field, start putting this on tape. And then you start to learn about a lot of the rules. You know, you've got to be up there for a minimum of 2 years. Once you sign a contract in the CFL, there's rules about how many foreign-born players that they can have on certain rosters. So that changes the way things get allocated. And so I end up going through camp there and getting offered a practice squad spot because, as it turns out, offensive line is a pretty easy place for them to stash Canadian guys so that they can import the American skill players up there. And so I'm sitting around like, I'm not going to sit up here and wait on a practice squad to try and get on the field up here, maybe, where I'm supplanted against, you know, the international politics of the game. And so I decided, you know, that wasn't for me. I turned down the practice squad offer, went and played in the FXFL, a minor league that was going on in the fall, just to try and, again, get something on tape. And then, you know, ended up with another tour with the Saints. The Rattlers thing was just sort of they wanted my rights in the Arena League. I never ended up actually going and even going to camp with them. It was I did that last tour with the Saints. I went out through training camp, made it all the way to the end, and got cut again. And at that point, I looked around and I realized that being a fringe roster guy, trying to go around through training camps and end up being camp bait doesn't pay well, and there's not a lot of stability, so I better start looking for something that's going to offer me a little more of those because football doesn't seem to want me around much.
Yeah, so, I mean, how hard was it to, like, pull the trigger and say this is it?
You know what? I think it was easier at the time because you're just so frustrated with the process. And you understand that at that point, you know, I really believe I had put everything that I could have into that process and tried to max out my physical abilities and the opportunities at the time. Because at a certain point when you're coming at it from the undrafted free agent side, especially a lot of it is timing and where you end up and then making the most of those opportunities, obviously. And for whatever reason, a couple of things don't bounce your way and it looks a little different. Now it's tough because, you know, I still have plenty of friends that are playing and working in this industry, you're around it and you watch it all the time. And you certainly feel at times that lack of fulfillment of not being able to accomplish. Because anything that we do, we all, you know, are competitive and want to be the best at. And so to not have been able to count yourself in that grouping is always going to be something I think that bothers me. And that's just something I reconciled with a while ago that, you know, you take pride in the fact that you gave it everything you could and it didn't work out. But that doesn't mean you're not sour about it.
Right. And I remember, you know, after college, I went and did stuff out in L.A. for a couple of years before I went back to the sports world. And I remember just the first couple assignments that were actually on location where I was at the Bulls practice facility or at Wrigley Field, at Soldier Field, instead of just being in the stands watching. When I was back on the field talking to the athletes, there was a lot of, like, pangs of, oh, like, I really wish I was still playing anything. So to be as close as you were, I can imagine that there's times early on, probably not so much anymore, you've sort of settled into this new career, but early on where just being around people still getting to do it hurts a bit.
Oh, yeah, that first, the first fall or two, I mean, this is fall number three for me out of football, but the first one, really, it was hard to watch a lot of those games because you're seeing guys that you were in camp with, you're seeing guys that, you know, may have gotten cut with you and got picked up somewhere else, and you're scratching your head wondering, all right, like, I was better than that guy doing the kind of, you know, weird thing, measuring thing we always do with that.
Yeah.
And it is. It's easy to feel sour about that. It's easy to feel sour seeing guys that, you know, may not have been as polished football-wise but have certain athletic traits and abilities that make them a little more desirable. And that was the one thing I kind of had to reconcile with was, if I sit around here and get mad at every guy who's getting an opportunity in a league that, listen, rewards traits like that and needs traits like that, I'm going to be mad for a really long time. So you just, you have to sort of be at peace with the situation as much as you can and just go from there.
All right, so let's talk about the first gig that you had in broadcasting.
Yeah, so for me it was the Fantasy Focus. It was Sunday mornings in the fall, 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern, with Dave Rothenberg and Eric Carabell and Stefania Bell, who went on there. And it was basically, you know, a few weeks into the season, because as I was trying to, you know, get my way in, there's, you know, a bunch of stuff they had to go through to try and figure out if there was even room to get me in. And they asked, you know, do you play fantasy football? And I lied and said yes, because I'd never really played fantasy football
you
before.
Haven't. I'm surprised.
No, it was one of those things, like, not to be like, you know, I was busy playing, I didn't have time for fantasy sports, I was playing real sports, but it just never came up. It wasn't something that my friends at Notre Dame really did, the guys that I was with, and so when it came time for that, it was one of those, you say yes because it's the opportunity, and then you immediately go to the internet and every fantasy magazine and try and pick up what you can and go from there.
Right. So you fudge your way through fantasy to get your feet in the door. And was that first gig, was it high profile enough for you to really hear the criticism of the people calling nepotism or saying that you jumped, you know, past the initial gigs that you should have done elsewhere before making it at ESPN? Or was that where you first might have heard some of that?
Oh, yeah. That started pretty early on in the whole process and, you know, was something that, because it happened in football too, I knew was going to come no matter where I ended up hopping through. And, you know, it's like anything else. You hear enough of it and part of it bothers you, and then after a while you just sit there and go, all right, well, I can't really change for the opinion of these people. If I'm doing something that I like and want to do, I'm going to keep doing it and not going to stop because a bunch of internet trolls seem upset that I am where I am. And so you just put your head down and plug away and in that spot and trying to, you know, pick up other works. I mean, that was basically my plan coming in, is I'm going to be around. I moved back home. I lived at home for the first year and a half. And I was going to be constantly available. I was going to say yes to everything, and I was going to do it really, really cheap.
Right, exactly. Yeah, well, everybody has to start like that. It's unfortunate. You get more money working, you know, as an unpaid intern. Somehow you spend money just to work in sports, I feel like, when you first get started.
Exactly. But like you said, I mean, I was also cognizant of the fact that I did jump places in line because of my last
right.
name. And that's something I've never really denied in all this, because denying it would be stupid and completely.
Right, that would make people angry.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. But you have to say, yeah, I got a leg up, and now I'm, you know, working my hardest to make sure that I deserve it and I keep it and I prove everybody wrong and, you know, all that stuff. That's the only way to do it. What did your dad say advice-wise when you got started about hearing all of that?
Advice-wise, he knew that was something that had always kind of come with everything I had done, because when you try and do the same things that your dad did just because they're your interest, it's always going to be perceived that way. And he said the same thing. He goes, you can control how hard you work at this. You know, you know exactly what got you in the door, but you understand that they are by no means obligated to keep you because I'm around here. And so if you don't perform, it's like sports, where along a long enough timeline in sports, man, if nepotism was really popping off like that, I'd probably still be playing on Sundays somewhere.
Right.
And so I'd imagine that if nepotism really, you know, was a thing like, or, you know, it wouldn't work like that in almost any facet of life. And so for me to expect to just get to stick around and pick up more and more gigs at ESPN because dad's over here would seem ridiculous, and that'd just be bad business on anyone's part. So I like to think that at this point, over a long enough time period, I've proved that I'm at least worthy of being around at 4 to 6 a.m. Monday through Friday, if nothing else.
Well, and also it would look terrible for the company if you were blatantly bad and you stuck around, right? Then it's obvious why you're around, and that would reflect very poorly on them.
Exactly.
And on your dad. Your dad would look bad, like he was, you know, keeping you around.
Exactly. It would be pretty glaring at that point. And so for me, it sort of redoubles the effort where you're saying, all right, I need to get in front of a mic as much as possible because everyone tells you how important reps are, because I want to go out there and do well at this. It's just like sports. It's just like we said, you know, you want to be the best at whatever you're doing. You want to go out there and you're competitive with your peers. You see the people that come in around the same time as you, and you see, you know, what they're doing and listen to the work they're doing, and you say, all right, I want to make sure that I'm matching or exceeding my peers, because at the end of the day, it's, you know, sports media is a lot like sports and how competitive it is.
So you're doing like the morning shows, and you started out, you were hosting with Robin Lundberg, the First and Last, and then on Sundays you host with Stu, but now First and Last is solo for you early in the morning. As you've approached every gig you've gotten, and as you've continued to sort of advance your name and your notoriety, are you conscious of your quote-unquote brand? I feel like it's something that we didn't used to talk about as much. It was almost sort of annoying or obnoxious to talk about one's brand, but because of the influx of people and coverage, there's so many websites and radio stations and podcasts and places to get your info. It's sort of necessary now to be aware of why you and why people would pick you. Do you think much about your brand?
Not in like an artificial sense. Like, listen, I understand the things I'm interested in, and I understand the things that people kind of associate with my family's name in general. I mean, my dad's built an identity on shoving donuts in his mouth and trying to say sentences on air, and the apple didn't fall far from the tree on that stuff. But that was one of the other first things that he told me going into this, is be genuine, because especially in something long form like radio, you're going to be in front of a mic enough to where if you're not, it's going to show up. Like, people are going to be able to point that out, and I'm not smart enough to keep up some sort of alter ego. I'm not smart enough to manage some sort of character the way other people are. And so I just went out and tried to do the things that were naturally me. And, you know, I play up on the idea of the fact that I am 28 years old at this point, and so I'm a little bit more dialed into things, and, you know, than, you know, guys like my dad's age and Greeny's age and Trey Wingo's age would be dialed into. And I try and play to those strengths, and I try and play to the things that I like and infuse them, because I always think about what I listen to in radio. You know, I want to listen to people that I like, because you're right, you're going to get the same information more often than not anywhere. It's whose opinion's interesting enough to me, who, you know, am I generally entertained by. It's like, you know, picking who your friends are. You listen to who you would basically want to hang out with for a couple hours a day. And so I go out there and I try and be myself, and I hope that people enjoy hanging out with that guy.
Do you find that you are often stereotyped by being a football player, the son of a football player, a Notre Dame grad, a, you know, sort of meathead offensive lineman guy? Do you find that often people's expectations of you are not really who you are?
Yeah, I mean, their expectations, it's a lot like dancing at a wedding for me. So when you're 300 pounds and white and you're going to a wedding, no one expects you to be able to dance well. So all you've got to do is display some minor bit of rhythm and you're the greatest dancer that's ever lived. And so for me coming into this, it's a lot like that, where they look and they see offensive linemen and they know my dad was a hand in the dirt guy and they know you played as well. They come into that. And so I enjoy kind of bucking that trend a lot of times when it comes up. And it does, especially now. I mean, we've got so much stuff going on with CTE and football like that, that the prevailing notion is that because you play football and work in an industry that benefits from it being around, that you can't have an opinion to the contrary, or that your opinion, regardless of what it is, doesn't deserve merit because you're in the pockets of football. And it couldn't be further from the truth. And so in all of those little areas, you like to remind people that no, like, I'm going to be well thought out with the best of them. I'm going to go out here and not just be, you know, the guy that falls back on all those tropes. Like, I want to be good at all of this. I want to, you know, do my homework and make sure that I can have a broad spectrum of conversations, not just tell you stories from when I played.
Right. And that way you got to start out sort of like a woman in sports, where you get one thing right and people are like, wow, you know your stuff.
Oh,
and I'm like, okay, thanks.
It's got to feel gross. I can't imagine how bad it is on you know on your guys.
But
end.
For you, it's like, wow, Golic's kid, not such a dummy.
I mean, the first day, you know, producer Dan Z around yeah. here. So the first day, Dan moved over onto first and last. And like you said, I used to, you know, co-host with Robin, who was unfortunately part of the layoffs. And so part of the move after that was I had to start driving the show. I had to start, you know, coming in and out of breaks and doing the reads and getting to the hard outs. And the first day when I hit a hard out, it was like Dan Z it saw me do a backflip into a pool. He was so impressed. And I was like, man, like, all it is stopping when the clock says to stop. Like, it's we really dumbed down expectations that much? But, you know, Broadcasting 101 from Stu
right.
Gotz is manage
exactly.
expectations. So maybe I'm doing that right.
You're nailing it so far. Yeah, just don't get too good because then there's nowhere to go but up from there. And you might not be able to, let's be honest.
Yeah, listen, I'm very aware of the ceiling that probably is right there.
So you mentioned that you just did some high school game calling. Is that something that you want to get into more?
Yeah, I like the idea of calling games. I've gotten to do a few on radio during bowl season over the last couple of years. And, you know, cool moment for me and Dad, we got to call the Pinstripe Bowl on ESPN together during this
nice.
Last bowl season. And yeah, because it's the most like playing. Like, the way you prepare for calling a game is exactly like you'd prepare for playing a game. You're studying, you know, the players on both sides. You're watching a lot of tape. You know, I called a college game. It was South Carolina at Missouri like a month ago. And getting to be back on a college campus and talk to coaches and talk to players and kind of pick everyone's brain makes you feel really close to it. Like, you get that pinprick of nostalgia all over again where you get those familiar feelings. And it is. It's the most familiar. I think that's probably the word. So, and just keep trying to diversify. I was never a guy in football that did one thing great, so I subscribe to it. The more you can do gives you the better chance to stick around and be valued. And now in media, it's a lot of the same. I try and put my hand in a lot of pies and hope I weave myself into enough
literally.
Places where they can't get rid of me. Yeah, literally.
I mean, literally, like the more pies you have your hands in, the better your career is going to be because that's just buying into what everyone wants to see. Yeah, that's really cool. And, you know, what your schedule now – is so crazy and so off. Do you even know? Because you started, you know, with a kind of weird schedule. I don't think you've ever had a 9-to-5, right, where you've gone to an office?
No. It's a
right. So, like,
this was
I was aware that I did not want that kind of job where you know exactly how many vacation days you have. You know, if someone says, where are you going to be Tuesday at 3? You're like, well, I'll be at my desk. That's where I always am every day. You know, I knew I didn't want that. But I did have a couple different jobs that were that along the way while trying to make my way in this career. And that just, like, solidified for me what kind of schedule I like. Do you have any idea what schedule you would like if you weren't forced to be waking up at 2 a.m. every night?
No, yeah, you know what? Listen, like, there's part of me that certainly would enjoy a normal sleep schedule and to kind of get to operate on the time that everyone else does, but I figure I've got a window where youth and caffeine can get me through a lot for a few years. But no, I don't really know what an ideal schedule looks like for me at this point because, you know, the one question I get asked a lot is, you know, where do you want to be? And, you know, the stock question, 5 years, 10 years, like, what are your long-term goals for this? And I think I'm still at a place where I really don't know yet. That's why I want to call games and do stuff and make sure I try a little bit of everything to see what I take to most naturally, to see what I could see myself doing long-term in a lot of this. And I think as I get a better handle on that, it'll give me a better understanding of, all right, well, what schedule would give me the best chance to do the best at the thing I like the most and go from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you are just starting out and kind of getting a feel for things. Do you feel like your dad's schedule kind of prepped you for this? Because I've said since the beginning of time, and I will say it forever, you could throw trucks full of money at me and I would not want to do Mike and Mike. And I understand that it's incredible reach. It's beloved. It's crazy good money. It's, you know, the place everybody goes to start their sports day. But to me, that whole vibe of like needing to go to bed before the games happen and then waking up early enough to know what happened in them so that you can talk about them. And like that whole loss of the social life at night of dinners and seeing people, that's crazy to me. And he's been doing it for 18 plus years that like most of the time that you've been old enough to get it.
Yeah, you know what the interesting thing with him, though, is just doing Mike and Mike was actually really dialed back from what he had been. Like, you want to talk about crazy schedules. So when we lived in Arizona, my dad was working locally out there, and, you know, he finished playing. His last year was with the Dolphins. He started doing preseason play-by or color commentary for the Jacksonville Jaguars coming out of his NFL career. And so we lived in Orlando. He did that. He got a job doing local radio at KGME in Arizona and just doing pieces where he was basically paid as it goes. Like, you know, hey, if we got something for you, we'll let you know, and you'll be, you know, it'll be as needed. And so he was doing that out there, and then all of a sudden ESPN2 started. So it was, you know, NFL Tonight and all of those old shows on 2 where it's Keith Olbermann in a leather jacket and Susie Colbert.
Right.
And, you know, my dad going over there. And we lived in Arizona, so he would fly out to Bristol for that, and he'd be gone, you know, 3, 4, 5 nights a week sometime. And after a couple of years of that, it's like, all right, we kind of want our dad back. So we moved out to Connecticut and did that. But even once we got there, he'd be there. He got Mike and Mike, so he would go and do that in the morning. He'd stick around and do NFL Live later on, so he'd be gone from 4:30, 4:45 in the morning until 9 o'clock at night and get home in time to eat a little bit of dinner and do it all over again. And to his credit, when, you know, because he used to call games on the weekend too, so he was doing a lot for you know, my entire life in elementary and middle school.
So there was consistency to Mike and Mike, even though it was odd consistency.
There was, and then, you know, it afforded him the luxury, just the timing of when that show started to become a bigger deal, to where I got to high school and my dad went to ESPN and said, I'm not calling games anymore. Like, I need to be here for my, you know, he wanted to be here for me, my brother's football games, my sister's swim meets. He didn't want to miss any of that. That was where he sort of drew the line in the sand. And so he stopped calling college games at that point, and he stopped doing as much of the TV during the week. And Mike and Mike, the timetable of the success on that made it so that was still financially viable and all of these different things. But it ended up being something like, all right, that was a lot less than what he had been used to. So he could get used to that and allowed him to do the things family-wise that he really wanted to. So it weirdly ended up being the most advantageous option of the whole thing.
Yeah, for sure. And you witnessing that, clearly you understood the amount of work that goes into it, right? Like, it's a dream gig, but it's straight hustle. And that was, you can argue still 18 years later, when he's kind of reached the pinnacle of sports radio, he still is doing work that a lot of other people, myself included, are like, no, that seems too hard.
Yeah, it's crazy. And being an adult now and being closer to it, working in the same industry, I've had a lot more conversations about what it was like for him when he started, because he sees the things that I'm doing and he's like, oh yeah, he's like, I used to call high school football games. I used to call arena football games. And you learn more and more about what, you know, just when you're a little kid, looks like Mike and Mike, looks like your dad going and doing stuff at the Pro Bowl and doing all these glamorous things. And it's like, nah, man, every once in a while, there were moments where, you know, we were paying off 2 houses and trying to figure out how that was going to work, because they had just moved from Florida when we were in Arizona, and all this different stuff that you never realize at the time, because they do a good job of kind of making it always seem normal for us. And to your point, the work volume was just something that was always really normal, and that he, you know, never really complained about, never really said much about. He was just, that was always the way he was. He's the son of a bricklayer, and he always kind of fell back on that mentality.
And you seem like you guys love working together. You get along great. Did you have fights about things? Was there any animosity at any point, whether that was pushing back on following in his footsteps or just regular dad-kid stuff?
There was regular dad-kid stuff at time. I think the most pushback was really, the football-wise, is in high school we used to watch game tape together of my games every Sunday, you know, every Saturday or Sunday after the Friday or Saturday whenever we would play in high school. And we'd be down there and we'd be looking at the tape. And, you know, I mean, he was going so above and beyond. We were having, because my high school did a poor job of filming things, so we had someone else come in and film a lot of this stuff so we could watch it, so we could get ready for recruiting. And I owe him a lot for being willing to do that. But there's also the part of you that just finished playing a game and is a little, you know, raw to the idea of criticism. And he wasn't going to shy away. I mean, he was going to be honest about the things he saw, because he knew, and I told him, I want to be the best that I can be at this. And he said, all right, like, I'm never going to do anything you don't want me to do. But once you tell me this is what you want, you're willing to do the things it takes, I'm going to make sure we're doing the things that, you know, I know worked for me, that I believe are the right way to do things. And, you know, as a teenage kid, you're not always receptive to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, whenever people have their parents as coaches, I'm like, oh, Russ, it could be amazing. It could be great memories later in life, especially if you succeed, but can also be a recipe for disaster. So
yeah.
Don't always want to hear it.
No, it's funny, too, because then it does. It turns into some of the best. Like, I remember it still in college, because I was a guy that struggled to get on the field at Notre Dame. It took me 3.5 years and one of my best friends getting injured. But you know, the beginning of Wake Forest, my true senior year. My Braxton Cave was our starting center. One of my best friends goes down with a Liz Frank injury. I play the entire game. It's the first time I'd got on the field for extended reps in my entire career. And my dad had come on the field, you know, come on the road for every one of my games, especially my junior and senior year of college, just in case that something like this happened and I got to play. And I see him down on the end of the at the end of the game on the field and just start bawling, like, because this is what we had worked towards my whole life, and to finally get there and to have him there for that moment felt, you know, it felt right. That was the poetic part of all of this, that amongst all that other stuff actually feels like the movie and feels better in real life when it happens.
Now that you're a part of the industry and you're working at the same company and you see the machinations of behind the scenes and everything, what do you make of the end of Mike and Mike? It's been the kind of cornerstone of your family for 18 years?
Yeah, 18 years now. And, I mean, even before that when he was doing it with Tony Bruno, like I said, it's been in the consciousness of my, you know, childhood and adult life for the entire way. So I don't really know life without it. And that part'll be weird, but I think now more than anything, now that there's a definite end date, it's fun to kind of look back and talk to him and Greeny about the stuff from early on, like Just Shut Up Tuesdays and all the different things that went into getting Mike and Mike to that point where it became the big brand name that it is now. And I think it'll be fun to kind of celebrate that stuff, because as excited as Dad is now to you know, get the chance to work with me going forward on the new show with him and Trey, and as excited as I'm sure Greeny is to get started with his new show down the road, there's going to be a moment where they both kind of get to break away from the daily hamster wheel of getting up, like you said, and, you know, watching the game and doing the show and all this. And you get to look back at what you built for a second and realize that that just doesn't happen a lot in this industry, and kind of appreciate what you did.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing to do anything for 18 years with the same person. It's essentially a second marriage, right? And so it's pretty remarkable. And I would imagine that getting to continue it, but with a new, fresh voice and with you involved, means he gets that consistency of a schedule he's used to, but it's going to feel really different going forward, even if it's not that different, even if it's still just a sports radio show.
Yeah, and you know, he said that. He's, when people ask what the new show is going to look like, he's like, we're going to turn on the microphone and we're going to talk sports. Like, this isn't this isn't reinventing the wheel. But there was a part of him that got kind of rejuvenated by me coming on. Like, if I had been working ESPN, I wouldn't have been surprised if my dad's deal, when it had been up this time around, would have been it. Like,
really?
Him and my mom, and he's said this, like, I'm not breaking any news here, but, you know, him and my mom have a place in Arizona that's ready for when they do retire and they are done here. They're going to split time between there and South Bend. Like, they've got that all set up, and you know, they've hit a lot of their goals financially to where they felt like they were ready to move on. But all of a sudden, I showed up, and we started getting chances to do stuff together, and it did breathe a little more life into him. And he said that's probably the reason he's stuck around now for this last little go.
Yeah, absolutely. Plus, getting to work with Hal Lingo.
Man, what a revelation that's been in the last few months, finding out that his name was Hal.
How did it take us all so long?
I don't know. I guess we just weren't looking at the right spot. Leave it to Stu Gotts and the Levitard guys to be the ones
the
woke
investigative
enough to
reporting
dig this up.
Of Stu Gotts to find out Trey Wingo's real name. It's the first time Stu's ever done any actual investigative reporting, but it was a big moment for him. Before I let you go, you have to do the one thing everybody does.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Number one, what's the natural talent you'd like to be gifted with?
The natural talent I'd like to be gifted. I wish I could sing. Like, I can sing. I can carry a tune well enough. Again, like the same white guy dancing theory. I can carry a tune well enough to not be horrific, but I would love to be the guy with the golden voice. Like, give me Darius Rucker's voice, like that unique kind of smoky tenor. And let me go out and just absolutely nail it at, like, the Opry or something like that, and I'll be happier than a pig and shit.
I like that. Also good with the ladies.
Oh, my God. Well, that's the thing. Like, it was the Eddie Murphy stand-up. All you got to do is sing. Like, you can be
Adam Duritz is, like, a perfect example of that.
Oh, my God.
Like, amazing songwriter, amazing voice, and just gets the hottest chicks.
Yeah, must be nice. Yeah. And instead, I'm 28 and have a receding hairline, so look what God did.
Number two, what's your Desert Island album? You can only have one.
Desert Island album. I would probably go Kanye West Graduation. I've I'm one of the more vocal Kanye West stans. I'm a guy that, amidst all of his insanity, tends to defend him as long as he keeps making the good music that he has. And Graduation was an album that came out in 2008 when I was graduating from high school, so it had that sort of, you know, double entendre for me. And it was the first Kanye album that I had bought and really bought into, and I always kind of have a little bit of affinity. The one B to that would be Continuum by John Mayer, because my first breakup in high school, Continuum came out. It's an awesome breakup album, and John Mayer in general is just a huge legend.
Yeah, they actually talk about how the music that you listen to in high school and college is what sticks with you the longest, because you're creating all of these social bonds and interactions, and your shared experience is much more notable because you're around the same people all the time. And then when you get older, you have work, people, family, everything else bringing you, you know, to different places. So those moments when you associate the music with specific people and places and social groups tends to stick with you longer, which totally makes sense.
Yeah, that's probably why every time Clarity by Zed comes on, I dump a pitcher of Red Bull vodka in my head, no matter what setting I'm in.
Is Continuum the one that had Slow Dancing in a Burning Room on it?
Yes, Slow Dancing in a Burning
Room.
Okay, because
that's like one of the best breakup songs ever.
Oh, it's incredible.
If you haven't listened to it, listen to it. Not only is it like beautiful in terms of like the musical composition, but the lyrics are killer.
It's killer. And pair that one with I'm Gonna Find Another You. It's like a minute and 20-something second song, but it's the defiant post-breakup when you finally are back on your feet and you realize that you're going to be better off for everything that you went through.
Yep.
So it's a nice little redemptive tale.
Yes. Excellent job, John Mayer. Number three, if you could switch lives with someone for a day, who would it be?
Someone for a day. Wow. I always fall back on someone like LeBron James or Tom Brady, just because I've often said, like, LeBron James is better at basketball than I am at walking and breathing at the same time. And so I'd like to know what it's like to be unequivocally the best at what you do. Like, you can walk into any basketball court in the country, and you're the best guy at that thing, you know, acknowledged in the entire planet, probably. Because that's just something that I've never touched, and you know, probably, you know, as much I can have grand plans for myself, but that's a pretty tall order in whatever line of work you're in. And so, man, I'd like to taste that feeling for a day.
I'm surprised you picked LeBron instead of Michael Jordan, because Michael Jordan pulled off the receding hairline way better and was better at basketball.
That is true, but like, that's the one thing I can point to is the commonality between me and LeBron right now is like, we're both on the Chris Berman, like back hairline type deal. That's the one thing me and the greatest basketball player on the planet have going for us.
There you go. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Oof. The most scared I've ever been. So we were going to play, when I was at Notre Dame, we were going to fly and play Washington State in San Antonio. We were going to play at the Alamo Dome out there. It was like one of the off-site special games we do to basically go and play well in recruiting areas. And you fly the charter planes in college, and it's a big plane, and the South Bend Airport is a small airport, so you've got a short runway to try and take off, and you've got to kind of hit it at a steep angle. And so the problem with that is that occasionally you'll kind of hit those air pockets when you're going up. So we take off, we're going up pretty steep, and all of a sudden it's like that roller coaster feeling where the bottom just drops out from under you, but it was like 7 or 8 seconds of that. And so our whole plane is freaking out, and I'm losing it there. We're like grabbing our buddies, like trying to figure out what's going on. But I'll never forget, in the midst of all that fear, and I'm terrified at this point, I look over, and one of the linebackers on our team, completely unfazed, has his arms open wide, looking up to the heavens, ready to come home. I had never seen someone so calm in the midst of terror before, and so that gave me a lot of peace. It's incredible.
And that person was just, like, crazy religious?
You know, he was a little bit, you know, his name was Torian Smith. He was a linebacker from Rome, Georgia, big Southern drawl, and one of those guys that, was religious enough and was kind of at peace with himself enough to where he was like, I'm ready. Like, if this is it, I'm coming home.
Huh. That would make me feel better, I guess. Except I probably wouldn't feel quite so. I'm coming home. I'd be like, I don't know where I'm going. I'm very unsure about what lies ahead. So
this
it might freak me out.
This is a 50-50 shot at best.
Right. Exactly. All right. Number five. What would you consider your biggest failure?
My biggest failure? I'd say, I mean, in an honest moment, probably the NFL thing. Like, that'll be the one. I take that back. The one thing that'll bother me more than that's the national championship. I'd spend every day for the next calendar year thinking about that for extended periods of time with, like, a sick pit in my stomach.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that when I go back around campus now, and it's still a place where, you know, I get a warm reception and everyone's very kind and welcoming there, but there's always a part of me that's just going to be flat-out disgusted that I wasn't able to give, like, the one great thing back to that university that you can as your time as a football player and that we haven't had in a really long time. That one will always haunt me.
It is interesting how being close hurts way more than just not doing that well. Like, I can pinpoint the moments where if one little thing had been different, I would have won or gotten to whatever level that I expected myself to. But the ones where I just kind of didn't show up and didn't play well at all don't bother me nearly as much. That was like, I did my best.
Yeah, no, it's exactly what it feels like. That proximity, seeing the crystal ball, watching Nick Saban and them dance on our graves after that game. The worst feeling in the world is loser confetti. That's why to this day, whenever there's championship celebrations, I usually turn the TV off because I'm like, I don't need to see this. Like, I know what the shitty end of that feels like.
Yeah,
I don't want to watch someone else go through that now.
Yeah, the final four tiers always get me, those kids. Yeah. I never revel. That's why I actually got in a fight with Lebatard because he was talking smack about my Cubs when it looked like the run was going to be over. They had gone like 22 straight innings without scoring a run and, looked like the Dodgers were ready to be done with them. And he was like, oh, I'm sorry. I didn't like, I guess that's like a girl thing. Or is that, he called Jamel because he couldn't get a hold of me. Is that a girl thing? And she was like, no, we like talking trash. And I'm like, no, it's a me thing. Like, I love talking trash for fun, but when somebody's team loses, I just leave them alone. I just don't bother them because as an athlete and as a participant, like watching somebody fail hurts way more than the excitement of watching them win.
Oh, by far. I mean, that's the Hard Knocks thing. Like, that's why I don't pay as much mind to Hard Knocks because I got cut enough times. Like, I don't need to watch right. some guy's the look of disgust on some kid's face when he has his heart ripped out of him on national TV. Like, nah, forget that.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Number six, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
I would probably just say persistence. Like, I've always told people, whether it's in relationships or anything else, like, if you don't want me around or you want me to do something, you've got to be really explicit, because if I believe that there's an opportunity for it, especially when it comes to work, I'm going to hammer away at it until I'm absolutely told no, like, you can't do this thing. You need to go try something else. So it's probably to a fault, and it might be grating on people in my life personally, but again, I'm very upfront with everyone. Like, if you don't want me to do X, Y, or Z, you just have to state it explicitly, and I'm more than willing. I take direction very well, but I'm also just going to be like that force going in one direction until I'm told that's not an option.
I love that. Number seven, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Outside of the hairline, which obviously has, you know.
Hey, man, Brian Urlacher, Ryan Sandberg, come to Chicago. They are all over that.
Seriously, that fake Patty is hot in the streets right now, though. I think I'm closer to what Bomani's been telling me for a while, which is just to come on home and embrace the life as a bald man
right.
in 2017. But if I could change one thing, I think I'd like to listen better, and I think that's something I'm really trying to work hard on, certainly in a professional sense, but just in general in conversations. I find myself trying to lay out a little more because I am always someone that's been very chatty and been very, talkative by nature, and I've tried to make sure I do a better job of giving other people the floor and making them feel valued in a conversation because – I can be dominant at times, and I recognize that that's not always the most conducive thing to an actual conversation.
That sounded like exactly the words that have come out of my mouth my entire life. So we are both fighting that battle.
Cut from the same cloth.
Exactly. And finally, number eight, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
I would say honest, kind, and genuine. Like, I feel like those are the best things that someone can say about you, and just kind of indicate that, you were pretty truthful with everything. And I always like to think that if nothing else, I'm going to be straight up with people. I can mess up a lot along the way, but at the very least, you're just going to get the unfiltered version of me, and hopefully it's in line with those things.
Honest, kind, and genuine. Those are good ones. I appreciate that, and appreciate you giving me some time to chat.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me. Always
go take a nap, I assume?
oh, yeah, going to pass out for a few hours now and see if I can get ready to do a show again tomorrow.
Oh, and another thing.
Today on That's What She Read, a story by Jeff Passan of Yahoo Sports called This Is Why Bruce Maxwell Knelt During the Anthem. Jeff Passan is a fantastic writer, and the research put into this story and the reporting on the A's player, the young man who was the first in baseball to take a knee during the anthem, is really incredible. I'll read you just the lead of the story. The 2000 census counted 14,128 people living in Cullman, Alabama, a city in the northern part of the state halfway between Huntsville and Birmingham. 48 of those residents were black. Baseball took Bruce Maxwell an hour down the road to Cullman that year for a tournament. He was just shy of 10 years old, mature enough to understand that almost nobody there looked like him, innocent enough to believe it didn't matter. His father was African American. His mother was white. He couldn't control who he was. We won the tournament, Maxwell said, and a man stood up in the stands and he threatened to hang me and my dad. He is far from the only black man in America with a story like this, a moment when race is imprinted on his consciousness against his will. It is a rite of passage into a life of indiscriminate threats against his body, his being. It forever bends his worldview. The moment, however, does not resign him to see the world from that perspective solely. Maxwell, now 26 years old, grown, thoughtful, giving, conflicted, sees it like a military man, which his father was, and like an athlete, which he is, and like an American, which matters to him as much as any of those other prisms, because it combines the best and worst of them to offer a reality that is his alone. That's how the story starts, and it talks about why he decided to kneel at that game, how he talked to his teammates about the choice that he was making, how he has worked and moved through this life as a biracial man, and also talks about who he is outside of the game and who he's shown himself to be his entire life. And that's where some of the really great reporting is that Passan has done. You know, he goes back to his old alma mater and volunteers to run after balls that go out of bounds during men's and women's soccer games. This is a guy who's in Major League Baseball now, and he's out chasing balls on the soccer field while the rest of the alumni are hanging out and talking. And he's going back to do the same shift he used to do when he was a student. There's a bunch of stories about him, you know, volunteering at local high schools, picking up friends' kids from school, bringing out kids onto the field to show them what it's like to be out in minor league fields when he was still working his way up to the bigs. Just, it sounds like an incredibly positive and giving kid, but also someone who has seen the worst of society and has been hated for nothing more than just being born the color that he is. And it's a really great story to read, and it's a great story to think about as you are watching other athletes speak out or kneel or peacefully protest. What parts of their life do you not know about? What stories have been embedded in their minds since they were kids about how they are treated or seen purely because of their skin? It's a great story, and it's a great kind of way to look at the larger picture. It's called This Is Why Bruce Maxwell Knelt During the National Anthem by Jeff Passan. You can find it on Yahoo Sports. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
Well, that's what she said.